This is the lecture for Biochem 421 for November 11,
2009. This is November 10, isn't it? November 11, Biochem 421. And we're in the middle of chapter 15 looking at hemoglobin. This is figure 1531 on your handout. May not match what's exactly in the text, but it's there in the handout. And it deals with the relationship of the porphyrin ring and the relationship of oxygen to it. Notice, if you would, when oxygen is not bound to it, is it puckered or not puckered? When oxygen is not bound to it, is it puckered or not puckered? It's puckered when it's not bound. It's puckered. And though, look at this. Doesn't this look exactly like an oxygen? Notice the two lobes. So when oxygen comes in and binds to it, it changes the ligand binding to the iron, and it shortens the nitrogen iron bonds, and they pull into the ring. So when oxygen's bound, the heme is in fact truly flat. It's not that way before oxygen bound. It pulls on what side chain? His F8, which is linked, of course, to what helix? F. And I know it doesn't show it here, but the F actually is a pivot and fulcrum. In other words, that there's a joint right here, a curve, and then here's the histidine, and as the histidine gets pulled down, there's an amplification effect a little bit when the helix is pulled along with it, and that changes the conformation of that particular subunit. And that information is then transferred to other subunits, enabling the oxygen to bind harder. Oh, did I say harder? Actually bind what? Easier. Called cooperativity. Exactly correct. All right. Now, ideally, of course, oxygen binding changes the myoglobin conformation, but so what? You have this hand up? You don't have this one?
No.
Do you have this one? All right, well, this is basically just a description of what this is. All right. So all we're saying here is iron pulls on its HIF-8 ligand along with it. The helix moves when the oxygen binds. The total movement of the iron is actually, it says here, 3/10 of an angstrom. The amplification makes it a 6/10 of an angstrom. Change means little to myoglobin. Why would the change mean little to myoglobin? Why won't you care? Why doesn't it matter when myoglobin binds oxygen?
Not cooperative.
Well, the reason why it's not cooperative is it's a single unit. Myoglobin does not have any multi-subunits. A single protein, as opposed to hemoglobin, which is a tetramer. But it means lots to hemoglobin. Okay. Physiological significance, hemoglobin must bind to oxygen in the lungs, must be able to release oxygen in the capillaries. If hemoglobin behaves like myoglobin, very little oxygen be released. And the sigmoidal cooperative oxygen binding curve of hemoglobin makes this possible. It's a cooperativity that makes it possible. The binding curve simply illustrates it. Okay, do you have this particular one? Ah, excellent. When deoxyhemoglobin crystals are exposed to oxygen, they shatter. In other words, that you can completely eliminate oxygen from hemoglobin. And then you can take those molecules and crystallize them out, and they form little tiny crystals, microscopic crystals, in a pure nitrogen atmosphere, for example. And you put them under an optical microscope to look at them, and then you allow oxygen into the region where those crystals of deoxyhemoglobin exist, and they literally shatter. They go boing. They just, and what's left is a powder scary everywhere. So there must be some sort of physical structural change. One alpha-beta pair moves relative to the other by about 15 degrees upon oxygen binding. 15 degrees, that's actually a massive change, is induced by that iron movement about 3/10 of an angstrom. See, they keep using different numbers. Just call it 3/10 of an angstrom when oxygen binds. So if you could imagine, if you would, ladies and gentlemen, this model is not perfect, but if you could imagine that your two hands are two pairs of subunits. There's like an alpha subunit and a beta subunit, and another alpha subunit, beta subunit, and alpha subunit. And they're sitting kind of like this relative to each other. Like this, when they're not oxygenated. But when they're oxygenated, one of them relative to the other shifts about 15 degrees. Doink. So deoxygenated, first oxygen. Deoxygenated, first oxygen. And when that first oxygen binds and changes that conformation, then that is transmitted throughout the whole molecule, and then the other oxygens can bind more readily. It's also nice because there's actually a hollow right here in the middle. There's a couple fold symmetry hollow in the middle that we'll be talking about in a little bit. So you can see that right here, deoxyhemoglobin. There's a shift of 15 degrees oxygenated hemoglobin relative to the two pairs of subunits. Okay. The other thing that goes on here is this. There's some new notation that you need to be aware of. And I'll slow down. So there's a bunch of new audio that's been uploaded. It's not that recent, but it's up there now. What I want you to note is some new terminology that we will be using extensively from now on for a variety of enzymes. And that is this T and R. The T meaning tight and the R meaning relaxed. The tight meaning in this case means that it's in the deoxy form. And the R meaning relaxed means it's in the oxy form. So the T form to the oxy form shift, the T form to the R form is stabilized, shift is stabilized by. Now, what happens is, so the first oxygen binds and there's a shift. What keeps it shifted? Why doesn't it just shift back? Well, actually, it will eventually shift back, and there's an important thing to it, but that is stabilized. That initial shift is stabilized by, of course, ligand binding. The T state is stabilized by salt bridges that are shifted upon oxygen binding. The ejection of BPG from the central cavity. Now, that's something new you haven't seen before. The salt bridges are new. The BPG, bisphosphoglycerate. It's actually 2,3 bisphosphoglycerate. We'll talk more about this later. The change in one subunit conformation alters all three subunits simultaneously. Simultaneously. Let's take a look at this bottom graph here. All right. Now, if bottom diagram, if you have, and this is where the fingers kind of come in handy. If you would allow me the privilege of examining, let's see here. If you kind of look at my ring finger on my right hand and my index finger on my left hand, as I'm sitting here in the deoxy form, there's a salt bridge that exists there in the deoxy form. That's similar to what you see there. You see the ASP G199, the tyrosine C7. That's a salt bridge due to the opposite charges of those two amino acids. That exists in the T state. When oxygen binds, and that's actually a favorable stability state. When oxygen binds, it shifts over one or two amino acids in three-dimensional space and then binds, these two things bind. The aspartic acid and the asparagine then bind. Boom. And so you get one type of salt bridge, then you get a different type of salt bridge or different configuration of salt bridge. And so both the deoxy is stabilized, because of that salt bridge. And then when oxygen binds, another kind of salt bridge is stabilized. But interestingly enough, it's, how can I describe it? There's a resistance to this change. It's kind of like two magnets. You're kind of trying to pull two magnets apart that are attracted to each other. And so you kind of go, click. There's a click when this happens. And there's still some tendency for it to want to go back to the deoxy form. Tink, it'll snap back. Just like, you know, you're familiar with these physical mechanisms. I don't know, it's like a drawer. You know, ever been to somebody's house that is rich and they spend a lot of money on the drawers? You probably haven't paid any attention to it. But anyway, you pull them open and there's a resistance to pulling them open and they slide out. And then as you begin to close them, you get to a certain point and they suddenly just snap back. Ever been to a place like that? Yeah. Well, that's kind of what happens here. The first oxygen is kind of hard to bind and then it binds. But if you remove enough oxygen, it'll kind of snap back to the deoxy form and help push that last oxygen out. Now, what did I just say? I said there's resistance to movement away from the deoxy form. So the oxygen concentration keeps getting higher and higher and higher and higher, and suddenly it snaps into the deoxy form, and all the other oxygen comes in. But as the oxygen concentration decreases, and the amount of oxygen bound to the hemoglobin decreases, it gets to a point where all of a sudden, it snaps back to the deoxy form and pushes out, encourages those last few oxygens to be ejected from the hemoglobin. So that's part of the stabilized form by the salt bridges. This BPG is also an important role to play. But we'll talk about the BPG in a little bit. We'll talk now about the Bohr effect. The Bohr effect. And no, it doesn't have to do with how exciting my lectures are. Okay? Right? Ms. Markovic? Any rate. So, discovered by Christian Bohr. Does that name look familiar? Christian Bohr? Actually, it shouldn't. The last name should. Of course, we're familiar with what? Bohr atom. Right, the Bohr model of the atom. This guy is that guy's father. So the Bohr effect in your blood is the father, discovered by the father of the guy who was it Niels Bohr? Yeah. It's amazing, isn't it? Science kind of runs in a family. It can, doesn't have to, but it can. This is binding of protons diminishes oxygen binding. And the binding of oxygen diminishes proton binding. Important physiological significance. So, here we go. We got our deoxy form. In our deoxy form, turns out there's quite a few hydrogens bond to it. Hydrogen ions bonded to it, sprinkled throughout the structure of the hemoglobin. When I bind oxygen, those hydrogens are released into the environment. Okay. It also turns out, and this is the essence of the Bohr effect, that if I have enough hydrogen bonds, enough hydrogen ions, that I can force the hydrogens back onto the hemoglobin and move it from the oxy form to the deoxy form. Okay. So, what I want you to say here is the binding of protons diminishes oxygen binding. Under here say, low pH favors deoxyhemoglobin. Low pH favors deoxyhemoglobin. And then I want you, that is the essence of the Bohr effect, that high levels of hydrogen ion or low pH favor the deoxy form. You can see that right here. All right. So, What happens is this. The oxygen saturating values for myoglobin and hemoglobin at five different pH values. Is there any change in the oxygen binding curve for myoglobin at any of those pHs? Apparently not. Why not? There ain't no cooperativity. It doesn't matter in myoglobin. But look at hemoglobin. Notice, would you say pH 7.6 is basic or acidic relative to normal pH? By the way, what is normal pH? 7.4. That's right, 7.4. So you make a little basic, and there you go. You make a little acidic, and you keep moving these oxygen binding curves. They keep going to the right on the saturation, on the saturation graph. Now, how is that helpful? Well, let's take a look. Let's do our little percentages here. Notice in the lungs, it's always about the same. There's such a large excess of oxygen in the lungs that just about no matter what's happening into your pH of your blood, you're going to get just about full saturation of the hemoglobin. What did I just say? There's such a large excess of what? Oxygen where? In the lungs, that no matter what's happening to the pH of your blood, oxygen is forced onto the hemoglobin. Okay? The critical issue for you in your life is what happens in my big toe or what happens in my muscle tissue or in my liver when the pH changes. Now, so, we'll start out at 7.4. That's approximately normal, actually. And by the way, 7.6, you're pretty sick. You got alkalosis. You're pretty sick. 7.2, you've got acidosis, and you're pretty sick. 7.0, and you're dead. If your blood is a pH of 7, you are no longer with us. Okay? You only have a range of about 0.4 of a pH unit within your blood, and you're dead, and you're very sick when you're feeling really bad when it's off by 0.1, and you're feeling really bad if it's off by 0.2, and you're not feeling anything if it's off by more than that. Okay, so, and that has nothing to do with oxygen carrying capacity. It has to do with the behavior of enzymes in the blood and blah, blah, blah. So, notice here, let's see here, follow the green line. What percentage saturation do we have in the lungs? It's about 95%. We bring it back down here to the green. We see it's about 85%. Okay? So we're delivering on normal. Right now, most of your oxygen is, most of your hemoglobin has lots of oxygen bound to it. It's not having to deliver that much. There's enough of it that it delivers, what, 15% or so, 10%, and it's enough to keep you going. But notice what happens if your pH level changes. Let's say it goes from a 7.4 to a 7.2. Your blood becomes slightly acidic. Now, what did I say? I said excess protons favor the what? Deoxy form. Excess protons, low pH, favor the deoxy form. Do you see that here? Yes, because I go from, again, about 95% at pH 7.2, and now I'm all the way down here at, what, 68, maybe 70% saturation, and all I did was to change the pH. And so this gap right here is the increased delivery of oxygen. What did I just say? I said that gap was the increased what? Delivery of oxygen. And if I change the pH even more, say pH 6.8, my goodness, look how much more oxygen I deliver. Not necessarily pick up, but look how much more I deliver in high hydrogen ion concentrations. What effect is this called? The Bohr effect. But Dr. Novak, you're going to die if you have pH of 6.8 or 7.0. You're going to die. Well, that's true if all your blood was pH 7. Or pH 7.2, or even 7.6. Did you ever have a track and field day in the academy?
No.
No. You did, Ryan? Yes, okay. A day to get out in the sunshine and not do any work? Yeah. Did you ever participate in any kind of athletic activities?
Track and field.
Track and field day, yes. Yeah. So what did you participate in, Ryan?
High jump.
Very nice. Did you do any running at all?
A little bit.
A little bit? What distances did you run?
They did a mile run.
Yeah? Yeah, I understand. Did you do the mile at all?
No.
You did? How well did you do? Ah, yes. Well, that's because you're burdened down with all the weight of the knowledge in your head. Okay. Exactly. So tell me, what was happening near the end of that mile? Were you beginning to sense a burn in your legs?
More
in your lungs. Very nice. But you never noticed any tightness in your legs or major muscle groups? Ooh, okay. Well, you have an excellent circulatory system. I, of course, I start running. I have a very poor circulatory system in my legs. And I can feel the burn long before my lungs give out. Anybody else like that? Do you legs give out, or do all your lungs give out first? What's happening when you're running like that? And there's a point to all this discussion, by the way. What's happening with when your legs and your muscle groups when you're running like that? You're running out of oxygen, and you're starting to produce what? Lactic acid and excess carbon dioxide. The excess carbon dioxide is not being taken away by your bloodstream because of the poor circulation. And that excess carbon dioxide reacts with as carbonic anhydrase in your red blood cells and produces bicarbonate and hydrogen ion. And that means locally in your major muscle groups, in the microscopic areas of the capillaries, you can have pHs that are down at 7.0 and 6.8 temporarily. Which means that at that point, are you delivering more or less oxygen? More. So the Bohr effect is a very important way of you surviving, because as you're running away from the lion and your pH in your muscle groups drop, it's without you thinking one iota of it, it begins to deliver more oxygen to your tissue, which is what is going on. Mindlessly, but automatically, as sure as the sun will rise tomorrow, it'll do that with it. So that is the Bohr effect. And it's very, very important. And it's because the Bohr effect deals with an excess number of protons or hydrogen ions. Let's take a look at it a little bit more. Globin prevents strong binding of iron, oxygen, excess oxidation, heme. The Bohr effect, upon binding oxygen, HB releases hydrogen ions. Converse is true upon binding hydrogen ion excesses, oxygen is released. What did I say? I said hydrogen ions stabilize the deoxy form. Hydrogen ions stabilize the deoxy form. You can see that right here. Here's HX with O2N. We add another oxygen to that, and we lose some hydrogens. This is in equilibrium. So in the lungs, where there's excess oxygen, we release lots of hydrogen ion. But in the tissue where there's lots of hydrogen ion, it forces the equilibrium back to the left and releases what element? Oxygen. Again, that's called the what? Bohr effect. Now, 0.8 molecules of carbon dioxide produce very oxygen consumed. Carbon dioxide is reformed into bicarbonate in the red blood cell by the enzyme carbonic anhydrase. Inside the red blood cell, there's no carbonic anhydrase outside of the red blood cell to speak of. So you can see that carbon dioxide plus hydrogen plus water yields hydrogen ion and bicarbonate. In capillaries with low oxygen concentration, high carbon dioxide, the oxygen is driven off the oxyhemoglobin by the hydrogen ion produced by the carbonic anhydrase. That is the Bohr effect in a nutshell. Okay, Bohr effect. Yes?
There's another.
Is there another line? Oh, okay. The pH change alters the binding curve for hemoglobin. You can see that. Oh, do I have to go backwards? Boom, 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 boom. So what did I just say? The hydrogen ion concentration alters the binding curve for hemoglobin. Boom, 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 boom. This is the one. This is the way I wish all of them behaved, but they don't all behave that same way. Bohr effect 2. You don't have that? Really? Okay. Well, then, fine. Do you have this next one? All right. Well, on this one, say CO2 binding to the N-terminus. N-terminus of the four subunit proteins. So carbon dioxide binding to the N-terminus of the four subunit proteins. A stabilizes the deoxy HB. Provides an important transport method for CO2. Okay. About 80% of the CO2 transported from the tissues is carried by carboxyhemoglobin. Carboxydeoxyhemoglobin. Carboxydeoxyhemoglobin. So, carbon dioxide binds to the N-terminus of the four subunits. So, hemoglobin fully involved with carbon dioxide on the termini is carrying how many carbon dioxides? How many N-termini are there in hemoglobin? Four, because there's how many subunits? Four, and they're all independent enzymes. And they have four N-terminuses and four C-terminuses. Exactly correct. So, the carbon dioxide binding stabilizes the deoxyhemoglobin and then provides that important transport. Doesn't carry a lot, but there's such a continuous turnover because if it stabilizes the deoxy form, guess what happens? When it gets in the lungs and the lungs are oxygenated, the hemoglobin's oxygenated, what happens to the carbon dioxide? Falls off the deoxy form, exactly correct. So you can see this right here. Notice stripped hemoglobin does not contain carbon dioxide, nor does it contain this material called BPG, which we'll get to next. So, as you can see here, carbon dioxide, the presence of carbon dioxide, shifts the binding curve to the right. What did I just say? The presence of carbon dioxide shifts the binding curve to the what?
Right.
To the right. I want to show you something else as well. Notice, changing the pH to its lower pH, acidifying the blood, shifts the oxygen what? To the right, increasing transport effectiveness. So shifting this binding curve to the right means we're talking about increasing transport effectiveness. So the Bohr effect, which is hydrogen ion, shifts it to the right, increasing transport effect. The presence of carbon dioxide increases the transport effect. Where do you find excess carbon dioxide? In the legs or in the lungs? In the legs. Where do you need the oxygen to be dumped off at? In the legs. Brilliant. There's another material called BPG. 2,3-bisphosphoglycerate. 2,3-BPG. Let's see here, what time do we have? Oh, we have plenty of time. Excellent. All right, allosteric effector of hemoglobin. This thing is very important. It's nearly as important as is the Bohr effect. Absence of 2,3-BPG, oxygen binding of hemoglobin follows a rectangular hyperbola. Okay, it's pretty close to being like myoglobin, but it's not exactly. A sigmoidal binding curve is only observed in the presence of 2,3 BPG. I'm not sure. Well, see, there's that strip. It doesn't contain much bind. There's a microscopic amount of binding curve right there without the BPG, but it really isn't much. The sigmoid, since 2,3-B binds at a tight distance from the iron binds the oxygen, it's an allosteric effector. So, structure and function of hemoglobin. Notice the conformation of deoxyhemoglobin, oxy, how and why. Blah, blah, blah. Each HB has A to H, no D. Does myoglobin have a D? Yes. But does hemoglobin have a D? No. All right. So, remember I said this? I had this like this? In the deoxy form, there's a gap in there. Okay, and I'm not talking about the clothing store. In that gap can fit a small molecule called what? Go ahead, somebody say it. No? I know, it's an odd question, isn't it? The molecule that we just got finished talking about is what? Okay. In this gap, right there, in that hollow, in that symmetrical hollow, a small molecule called 2,3-BPG can fit. It stabilizes the deoxy form. What did I just say? Stabilizes the deoxy form. My goodness, we've gone through this whole thing and we've come up with three molecules, three things that stabilize the deoxy form. What are they? What was the first one we talked about? Hydrogen ion. What was the next one we talked about? Carbon dioxide. And now we're talking about a third one called what? 2,3-BPG, or just BPG, stabilizes the deoxy form. That means it shifts the binding curve, which direction? Increasing the effectiveness of oxygen being dropped off. Oddly enough, however, that gap right there in the deoxy form fits 2,3-BPG just perfectly. In the deoxy form, it doesn't. It's too small. So in the deoxy form, 2,3-BPG is in there, stabilizing the deoxy form. Oxygen in the lung comes along and goes, I want on that hemoglobin. I'm going to get on there. I don't care what. Get out of my way. And so it becomes oxygenated. And then three things, actually four, three things fall off in the oxygenated form. What are the three things again? CO2, hydrogen ion, and 2,3-BPG. Alrighty then. Thank you very much. There it is. You do not need to memorize its structure, but it's a very simple thing. It's actually related. It's actually just a slight offshoot from the glycolytic pathway. There's a couple enzymes that make it. You find them in red blood cells. Where does the 2,3-BPG bind? Inside in the central cavity. What's special about 2,3-BPG? Negative charges interact with 2-lysine, 4-histidine, 2-N-termini. I don't care about the specifics of the negative charges. It binds them, and when you bind 2,3-BPG, you're stabilizing which form of the hemoglobin? Deoxy form, exactly correct. And it shifts the binding curve what? To the right, increasing the effectiveness of the what? Off. Now, fetal hemoglobin. Now, where do you find fetal hemoglobin? In foeticide, or foeti, fetuses, lower affinity for 2,3-BPG, higher binding affinity for deoxygen, so it can get oxygen from the mother. So, you've got a situation here where fetal hemoglobin does not interact with BPG, does not stabilize the deoxy form as much, and therefore can obtain a bit more oxygen from the mother's hemoglobin. It favors picking up oxygen from the mother's hemoglobin. That's how it survives in the womb. Of course, you have to understand, since it does not have an affinity for 2,3-BPG, that means under high exertion circumstances, the fetus would not have the same capacity to deliver oxygen. But is that high exertion, is that a real problem for most foeti? Well, not unless they go to the Y. Never mind. All right. What? There's no egg. The fetuses are just laying. Okay. They need to move and jerk, but they don't need capacity to deliver oxygen in a particular capacity. There's how that fits in the cavity. You don't need to memorize this. Here is a nice model. I would like for you to know this model really, really well. Okay? This gives you a mental image of how it all behaves. And we're going to go through this very quickly, next 2 minutes or so. Right. Oh, let me go back. There we go. Now, Bohr effect. The curve is shifted to the right as pH decreases. That means it's increasing the release of oxygen. Presence of carbon dioxide and chloride as well influences O2 binding. Carbon dioxide and chloride both bind more tightly to dioxide than the oxyhemoglobin. This favors the release of oxygen in high respiration. That means high carbon dioxide environment. All right, so I want you to circle chloride as well. Chloride. So we now have four, name them four, four small molecules or small items that bind to the deoxy form and stabilize it. Let's go through them again. The first one we talked about was hydrogen ion, and that was what effect? Bohr effect. The next we talked about was what? CO2 on the termini. The next we just talked about is 2,3-PPG that fits in the what? Cavity of the deoxy form. And finally, you now have the chloride ion, which actually also binds there. So, what I'd like you to do to improve this model a little bit is, notice if you would, let's take a look. I want you to look right there in the center. You see where it says HHB? That's the deoxyhemoglobin, because there's no oxygen with it. How can I tell there's no oxygen with it? Well, because if it was oxygen, it'd say HBO2. Okay? What I need for you to do is make a little dash right there and add a chloride, a Cl- to it. Right there, where the HHB is, add another dash somewhere, I don't care, some off-angle thing, and put in Cl- minus. To indicate that there are how many things binding to that deoxy form? Four. Okay, what four things are there bound to that deoxy form? The top one says what? This one down here next to it says the what? Hydrogen ion. The one below it says the what? And the one that's not shown but you just drew in there was? Chloride. All right. So, let's take a look here. You've got carbon dioxide coming in from the metabolism. It diffuses through the red blood cell. By the way, what do you think that little curve means? Where am I talking about here? This is the red blood cell, RBC. You notice the shape that reminds you of the red blood cell? Okay. So carbon dioxide comes in, diffuses through the membrane. You run into an enzyme. What is it? Carbonic anhydrase, that's right. Put a big capital C, capital A right there above that double-headed arrow. Capital C, capital A, and indicate somewhere on there that that's talking about carbonic anhydrase. Makes that, dissociates. Well, we're running out of time. We will talk to you then. Today's Wednesday, is that correct? That's correct. So we'll meet again on Friday. Thank you very much. Have a great day. What's going on? You saw this on the MCAT? And what about it?